Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 2nd of December 2016, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. Well, I'm pleased to be back, Mike, hopefully disease-free, but we'll see. Just a quick word on the weather. Utterly glorious here in Plymouth. We've got wall-to-wall blue sky. We've got sunshine. It's been pretty cold with quite a frost. And apparently similar day in Perth. Glorious wall-to-wall sunshine, blue sky. The rest of England is a bit iffy, so we'll leave that out of our weather report today. Bring in Boris.
I'm sorry I have to, but yes, he was speaking at Chatham House this morning. Well, apparently we have to redouble our resolve and defend and preserve the best of the rules-based international order. And this is really the theme probably of today's programme, Brian, the absolute panic and continuing sort of rhetoric coming out of the new elite, as they like to be known. David, did you know that we had a rules-based international order?
Well, I heard that we used to have. I thought that ended probably somewhere around the Vietnam intervention, and certainly by the time we're destabilising Syria and Libya and the rest of the Middle East, I thought that we had rather passed that one by.
Okay, well, let's see what else he had to say. He said, "I believe Britain is a force for doing even more for a rules-based system, and we should not be nervous to do so." And he said, "I believe that this country is overwhelmingly a force for good and potential to do even more." So I find that pretty incredible. Do you think we're a force for good, Brian?
I absolutely don't. I think if we look at the track record at the moment, we've got a criminal British government that is a force for everything that's utterly bad and evil. Live, can I ask for some explanation as to the rules-based system, and where has Boris got all this language from? He's not bright enough to have cooked it up himself, so this has come out of a think tank somewhere. What does he mean by it?
Well, that's a very good question. Any thoughts, David?
Well, this is a repackaging of George Herbert Walker Bush's New World Order speech, isn't it? That the New World Order was defined as the rule of law rather than the law of the jungle applying to the relationship between nations. Now, that all sounds very fine, but when you analyse it, it's not there, because there is no acceptance as to the nature of the rule of law that applies. International law has always been about treaties between independent nations, and what this is basically saying is we will overrule the independence of those nations and have a supranational body defining how countries are to be run. That's what it really means.
Well, indeed, and of course the point about a rules-based international order is that you don't have the rule of law, you've got rules, and the rules are made up by whom?
That's exactly it. The rules are made up by ?
An elite.
An elite, right. Let's see what else he said. He did, of course, say that we were going to get really tough with Russia, but that doesn't mean, apparently, that it's wrong to talk or engage. He said our resolve to fulfil our NATO obligations will be unbreakable. And we know that events in Afghanistan can affect our lives in London, and that's why we're still in there. At least that's partly why we're still in there, I think. Drugs is probably a significant part of that as well. He also mentioned that if they want to do that, this is the EU, if they want to build an integrated EU military, then that's absolutely fine. So there you go, Brian.
He just doesn't tell his audience that, of course, UK is to be a key part of that European military.
Okay, well...
quick question, Mike.
Yes, go for it, yes.
What is our war aim in Afghanistan? Because I thought we went in there to get Osama bin Laden, and then I thought we went in there to make sure that schoolgirls got education, and then I thought we were in there to create peace and harmony and democracy in Afghanistan. Is it now, because if we're not there, they'll attack London? I just need to keep up.
Well, I think the bit we can add is yesterday we showed that the British government was boasting that because of £1 billion it had to spend in conflict areas or areas of uncertainty, it was priding itself on the fact that taxes in Afghanistan had gone up from a mere few hundred million, $200 million, to $2 billion. So a country which is predominantly immensely poor, Britain is boasting that we've been into Afghanistan and we've now increased the tax base from a few hundred million to a couple of billion. So I think we're there to raise taxes. And Mike would say this is all part of the drug industry, which we are clearly helping to propagate.
Absolutely.
Well, that's good news. Thanks for that. It's been long traditional to have wars over taxes, including the American Civil War. So it's good to keep up these traditions.
Absolutely. Well, let's keep up the tradition by mentioning British foreign policy and Mosul. We were talking about the Mosul hypocrisy yesterday. In fact, we've been talking about this over the last few days. No particular information about this at this point in time. I just wanted to highlight the fact that that Frank Baker from the Foreign Office and Rory Stewart, Florence of Arabia.
Yes. They weren't sure whether he was a girl or a boy when apparently in Westminster.
Yes. So Florence of Arabia and Frank Baker are over in Iraq, telling the Iraqis what a great job they're doing in Mosul, getting rid of ISIS. So that's fantastic. Now, look, we were talking about the foreign policy of the West a second ago, and I just want to remind everybody about this, the Peace of Westphalia. Now, this was the subject of Alex Thompson's talk at the British Constitution Group conference, and I want to just read out the first clause of that, that there will be a Christian and universal peace and a perpetual true and sincere amity, that this peace and amity shall be observed and cultivated with such sincerity and zeal that each party shall endeavour to procure the benefit, honour and advantage of the other, and thus on all sides we may see that this peace and friendship flourish by entertaining a good and faithful neighbourhood. And this Westphalian order is what nation states have been about for the last few hundred years. And this is the foreign policy and the order which Tony Blair, when he was leaving Parliament, said was already outdated. And this is what they've been fighting against. Now, I wanted to highlight once again a quote that President Xi of China made some time ago, saying, "History tells us that the law of the jungle isn't the way of human coexistence. Every nation should obey the principle of equality, mutual trust, learning from each other, cooperating and seeking joint benefits for the construction of a harmonious world, sustained peace and joint prosperity." And those words are so he's clearly echoing the Westphalian position here and not the sort of globalist position of this new rules-based international order. Yesterday, they have published this document, The Right to the Chinese. This is The Right to Development, China's Philosophy, Practice and Contribution. And something that they're saying here is that the right to development must be enjoyed and shared by all peoples. Realizing the right to development is the responsibility of all countries and also the obligation of the international community. It requires governments of all countries to formulate development strategies and policies suited to their own realities, and it requires concerted efforts of the international community as a whole. China calls on all countries to pursue an equal, open, all-round and innovative common development, promotes inclusive development and creates conditions for all peoples to share the right to development. And of course, development is something that the West, David, has absolutely refused to allow so-called third world countries to do, because, of course, if they develop, they would use the raw materials that we want to steal from them. So it strikes me as interesting how Western nations like Britain and the United States are moving from the notion of being free towards totalitarian regimes, whereas China, which we all recognize has been a totalitarian regime, seems to be moving in the other direction.
Well, quite. The direction of travel is certainly reversed in the last few years since the wall came down, I guess. The attempt to use the fake global warming hypothesis to prevent development in parts of the world which are currently undeveloped or underdeveloped, and hence to confine millions born and not yet born to an early death via starvation and disease, and hence to reduce the population of the planet. Seems to me to be one of the most anti-human, anti-man, and cruel policies that has ever been concocted. And yet it is the settled international world, is the rules-based approach to international diplomacy. It's very encouraging to see some countries which have enough about them to tell the truth and have enough confidence in their own position to ignore the international howls of protest, speak out against this.
In the chat box, Mass Passive is suggesting that these are just words, that they sound good, but it's not the real world. But I would argue that, in fact, if you look at what China's doing, and we can be cynical about this if we like, but if we look at what China's doing to promote the development of other countries, it's not just about words.
Yeah, I mean, China's got its problems because they're still wedded to major elements of the communist ideology that is causing them a lot of problems. They're going to have economic problems as well arising from that. But the direction has been hugely positive. Look at the increase in life expectancy, the increase in living standards across huge swathes of the globe, and it's coming from development.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's move on to your Glasgow meeting. You had a great meeting.
It was very good indeed, yes. A packed hall again. There was about 70, 75 people were there, standing room only. And there were three speakers, myself, there we go, plus John Smith speaking on commercial liens and how he has been fighting back against fraudulent behaviour from people in authority, and the refusal of the court system to address the fraudulent and criminal behaviour and incompetent behaviour. So he's been doing that through a non-judicial process via the commercial lien. So that was an extremely interesting talk. I know a lot of people there were wanting to explore that further with him. And then we had Robert Green, who came up from Warrington to speak to us, and he rather wowed the audience, I would have to say. They were all delighted to see him looking so well and speaking so well and so bravely. It was a good night.
There was quite a bit of discussion in the chat box yesterday about Robert's impending visit from the bailiffs. Can you give us an update on that?
Well, they haven't been yet. There's a lot of kind of strange, unknown elements to this. One of the oddest is who is actually pursuing him. When the bailiffs are asked, they are receiving instructions from the Scottish government. Now, remember, this is a private civil case, but the bailiffs have been instructed directly by the Scottish government. So this is a political prosecution. This is using the civil law to hound political opponents. When asked the Scottish government, the legal directorate, who they were being instructed by, they said the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service, an organisation which has no part in civil legal proceedings, are apparently instructing the civil legal proceedings. And then when asked who exactly in the Crown Office was at the heart of this, so we could follow the chain further up, the person, Shona Bathgate, the lawyer for the Scottish Government, got extremely nervous and refused to answer the question. So we don't really know who's doing it. We don't really know too much about what will be done or when it will be done, because so much of it's in secret. They went to the High Court and got an order against Robert. Robert never knew anything about it. He wasn't informed. He had no opportunity to defend his position. Quite ridiculous and completely opposed to the laws of natural justice.
David, correct me if I've got this wrong, but I understood from Robert yesterday that he'd challenged the bailiff company on what was actually going on, and they had said to him, well, actually this action is coming from Eilish Angelini, but it's being fronted by the Crown Office of Scotland. And this is if this is true, this is a very interesting situation, because of course Robert has the letter from the Crown Office where they say that they have no power to act or intervene in civil cases. So if you put these little bits of jigsaw together, it would appear that Eilish Angelini is able to use what friends that she's still got within the Crown Office to do her bidding, or is something more sinister going on? Is this some sort of criminal enterprise operating within the Crown Office?
Well, the rule with the Crown Office, Brian, is if you can imagine it, they are up to it. The Crown Office is organised crime. But in terms of Angelini, she came after Robert for this money now several times, twice before with her own private firms of lawyers, different firms. So when Robert successfully defended his position, she would come back later with a new legal firm. And now she's now using the legal resources of the Scottish Government, it would appear, in some indirect manner to do this. Is this the fact that these actions require, on, shall we say, an incomplete briefing of the legal team in order to move them forward? We don't know. We really don't know what's happening. But it seems to be, it's all the smell of corruption. Why is the Scottish Government involved in this? It's a private civil matter. The Scottish Government should be within 100 miles of it.
Yeah, thank you.
Indeed. Right. Well, look, getting back to the meeting then, what were you discussing?
Well, yes, my sort of theme was how the cover-up works. And I was looking for an example of exactly what is going on and how the all aspects of society seem to accept certain lies or promulgate certain lies. And the example I came up with was the reporting of the Stalin period in Russia. Now, this was revealed by Malcolm Muggeridge, who said the following. He said, "Wise old Bernard Shaw, high-minded old Henry Barbusse, the venerable Sidney Beatrice Webbs, Andre Guy de Pure in heart, and Pablo Picasso the impure, down to poor little teachers, crazed clergymen and millionaires, drivelling dons and very special correspondents like your auntie, all resolved, come what might, to believe anything, however preposterous, to overlook nothing, however villainous, to approve anything, however obscurantist and brutally authoritarian, in order to be able to preserve intact the confident expectation that one of the most thoroughgoing, ruthless and bloody tyrannies ever to exist on earth could be relied on to champion human freedom, the brotherhood of man, and all the other good liberal causes to which they had dedicated their lives." Now, this was spot on, and referred to the reference to Durante was a reference to the Washington Times correspondent, who was originally born in Liverpool, an Englishman. He was the Washington Times bureau chief in Moscow during the Stalin show trials. New York Times, yes, it's the New York Times. Yeah. During the Stalin show trials, during the purges and during the famines caused by the Stalin's policy to depopulate the Ukraine and to eliminate private landholding amongst the farming community. And he covered it all up. He lied. He lied so effectively they gave him the Pulitzer Prize. So he was, in the 1920s and 1930s, he was fake news.
Right.
So it's not new.
No, indeed. Well, and it's going on as we speak, but not in the independent media, as far as I can see, as a general comment.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Let's bring in John Hurst. We had a report from John Hurst's court case yesterday, magistrate's court case. Now, we understand that John's been given a 2-month suspended sentence. He's got to pay 5% of his outstanding council tax sum per month. But the significant thing is he has been given leave to appeal this case on points of law. And John was very happy with this outcome because, of course, he said if he won his case in the magistrate's court, it had no standing as a law because it didn't represent a precedence. However, if this now moves forward to a higher court, there is the option of winning and putting a marker down. But of course, if we remember what John is doing, he's saying, I don't see why I should be paying my council tax, as this money is being used to support wars and terrorism. And some of it is also being fraudulently withheld from the purpose to which it was designed, which was helping the public So that was a good outcome yesterday, but we've got to wait and see when the follow-up case will take place and, of course, how that actually goes with John. But this is yet another case, of course, where the authorities are now being actively challenged. And I think these people must be realising now that the wider public are waking up to the overall scam of the tax, the system of taxes. Yeah. I don't know what you'd say about this one, David.
Well, it's extremely brave to fight them on taxes, because that's the area that the people who oppress us most need. Because what they do is they buy us, they bribe us with our own money. It's a wonderful trick. And that's how they remain in authority. It's the ability to tax. That is really the whole game. So anyone who challenges the authorities in this area has my enormous respect. And of course, when you look at things like, is it a contract? There is no contract. There's no valid legal contract. What there is muscle and might and threat.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Potentially controversial subject, David, but you wanted to cover this because the BBC promoting Elton John and David Furnish and saying that everybody needs to be getting HIV tests immediately.
Sorry, because Elton John says so, Mike.
Yes. Well, the government is mainly saying this, and of course Elton John is the poster boy for it. The government saying that, you know, tens of thousands of people, David, are running around the country with undiagnosed AIDS, and so we've therefore all got to get this done as quickly as possible. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I'd point out that there are certain things that I can say about Elton John that you can't say because you're in England, and there are various injunctions and things preventing free speech regarding Elton John in England.
So therefore,
so
you
will,
can't say
try
it on
and
this program
that and make sure I say nothing inappropriate.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
The idea of Elton John as a poster boy seems somewhat bizarre, and I was really struck by the fact that here we have Elton John giving medical advice to the entire nation and apparently leading the setting of medical policy for the United Kingdom. And I would suggest that he is in no way qualified to do any of these things, and I'm surprised that the BBC would even give him airspace to put these ideas forward. But apparently he's worth listening to, according to the BBC. And they talk about wanting to promote HIV testing on blood samples. So if you're in certain areas of England and you go in and they take blood, they will automatically test for HIV. And this is going to be a good thing and stamp out the disease. Now, there are many, many strange things about this. It's a very political disease. And the book that I'd like to recommend here is called Inventing the AIDS Virus. It's by a top American virologist and researcher called Peter Duesberg. He was at the top of his field. He was absolutely at the top of his field until he came up with an opinion, a hypothesis, a scientific hypothesis that did not suit the mood of the time. His hypothesis is that HIV has nothing to do with AIDS, that AIDS is caused by drug taking, and the reason that it's prevalent amongst IV drug users and people who engage in the fast-track homosexual lifestyle, which involves a lot of drugs as well, is because it's a drug-induced failure of the immune system, and that's what we're dealing with. It's a very interesting book. It's quite a thick book. I've got a copy there. It's quite a heavyweight piece of work, but it's absolutely fascinating, beautifully written, precisely written by one of the very finest minds in his field. It explains why the nature of AIDS is different in Africa from the West. It explains why sexually transmitted disease rates are spiking, but HIV rates are not. It has a great deal to recommend it. And it points out that there is no, the introduction from another scientist, a chemist who's a Nobel laureate, points out that his way into questioning this orthodoxy was when he asked the question, which scientific paper proves that HIV is the probable cause of AIDS? And he asked for years and he never got an answer because the paper does not exist. Yes. Citation does.
But David, we're not really surprised that the BBC should feel it needs to use Elton John, are we?
The BBC and Elton John, well, what a combination. You have a whole lot of things to do with covering up of allegations made of Elton John. You have media manipulation. You have a particular view of the world which is put forward and truths which are suppressed often by legal means and legal threats. And in all of this, the BBC is not only complicit, but seems to be happily complicit.
Just a final comment. We should probably point out that was the Victoria Derbyshire show. Is that correct?
That was the very same show who covered the sexual assault of boys in football clubs just the other day, and memorably or infamously covered the Ricky Dearman set up and produced the Ricky Dearman interview where he denied everything regarding the Hampstead abuse case. But the BBC, despite showing him through soft focus, weeping into the lens, omitted to tell the audience that he was an actor.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Scotland, then. Devolution. Here we've got David Mundell, who's the Scottish Secretary. Well, what's he talking about? Well, we've now devolved tax-raising powers to Scotland. You'll be pleased to know, David. I know you're particularly pleased about this. So NPI can now raise taxes from you directly. And with these landmark powers, he said, over income tax, the Scottish Parliament will become one of the most powerful devolved parliaments in the world. That must give you a warm feeling.
Well, you would think it would send a shiver down my spine, the idea that NPI can reach directly into my wallet and take out £20 notes whenever she feels like it. But, you see, there are limits. Because there's actually very little that NPI can do without losing support in Scotland, because there is no appetite in Scotland for giving any more money to the government in that regard. It's just like England. And, of course, England is the place where many people will move if Nicola decides to put up taxes to any significant degree. So there are the freedom of movement gives us a lot of protection against the more grasping aspects of our wise political overlords.
Well, you do get the power to raise your own taxes, but you're not getting any special deal for Brexit, according to Philip Hammond. And he, of course, was up there meeting NPI. He said that, is Britain going to accept the 62% Remain vote in Scotland? And he said, this is a UK issue, and the will of the people of the UK was to leave. And we're clear that we can't have a different deal or a different outcome for different parts of the UK. We have to work together as a United Kingdom now to get the best possible deal with Europe and then make our way in the world as a United Kingdom to the benefit of all parts of the UK. And he said, I look forward to us moving on from this slightly backward-looking, clutching at straws, trying to resist the will of the people, to embrace it, recognising it's going to happen, and committing to work together to make sure it's done in a way which is most supportive of the UK economy and the Scottish economy. So with that in mind then, because we are leaving, Brexit means Brexit, and we're definitely leaving. Well, the British government has decided that the letter that they sent to Nissan over Brexit is too sensitive to make public. We can't make it public. They've denied the Freedom of Information request to make it public. And the reason they say they've denied it is that they're still considering the public interest side of things. But they're a little bit worried about the commercial side of things. Basically, they're denying that they're going to be giving any kind of government support to Nissan. And any money that they do give to Nissan is covered by budgets that already exist. But basically, they won't make that letter public. And I'm going to say that the reason I believe they're not going to make it public, and you and Brian can comment on this, is because what they've promised to Nissan is that we're not leaving the European Union, nothing's going to change, and therefore Nissan doesn't need to worry.
Well, you might well think that, Mike. That's a very interesting comment. The secrecy is very interesting. The points by Mr. Hammond were, of course, all correct, and just an illustration of how disconnected from reality Nicola Sturgeon's government is over this matter, where she's trying to pretend that there can be some sort of border introduced because we are staying with the EU and you independent-minded English are going your own way. No, it was a national vote, and whatever happens, good, bad, or, and I think the smart money is on indifferent, we'll all be in it together.
Yes.
Well, I think just my comment on it is going back to the late 70s, I remember meeting a gentleman who was working at the time for Leyland, and he was telling me how the Leyland staff were just stunned at how their technology was just being hoovered out of the country and out of the company and freely given to Honda. And while we can recognise there were certainly weaknesses within the Leyland car production, quality in some areas being part of that, they had a whole raft of technologies which were world-leading at the time, transverse engines and various couplings. But, of course, this was the start of Britain's technology simply being given away to other countries so that the car industry could ultimately be shut down in UK. And I find it fascinating to see that here's the government having secret deals with another Japanese car company.
The most significant advances in car technology in recent years is anti-lock braking systems. That whole system, that whole technology was invented by a British Leyland engineer.
Yeah. We need to do a separate programme on some of that, yeah. The assault on Britain's manufacturing industry. Well, let's have a change of subject. And Donald Trump has been touring America to say thank you, thank you, thank you. And he said as part of his speech at Cincinnati, Ohio, we will destroy ISIS. At the same time, we will pursue a new foreign policy that finally learns from the mistakes of the past. We will stop looking to topple regimes and overthrow government, folks. So I found that a very interesting statement, that there'd apparently been a few mistakes in American foreign policy. We have toppled a few governments, but it was a complete accident. We don't know how it happened. It was just a bit of a mistake. But we're going to change the way we do things, and we're not going to mistakenly topple governments. So I wonder what was in Mr. Trump's head. And we're seeing now him assemble his advisers around him. And I thought this was an interesting place to go. And this is actually the Telegraph. And I encourage people to go and have a look at this Telegraph article. I should have a label on it. It is the Telegraph. And they listed out some of his new team. So I thought we'd have a look at a couple of them. So we've got General James Mattis, who's come in as the defense secretary. Let's have a look at this man. Now, he's known as the warrior monk because he's unmarried. He has apparently a huge library on war, but rather a controversial figure. These are some of the things he said. Marines don't know how to spell the word defeat. And be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everyone you meet. So this seems to be like a quality defense secretary. We can give you a bit more. Here it is. It says a voracious reader with a personal library of more than 6,000 books, and he's a student of anybody who's written on the subject of war, including the Bible, and apologies for a little bit of text which shouldn't be there. It also says it's fun to shoot some people. I'll be right up there with you. I like brawling. And these were remarks he made in a Californian panel discussion. So he's a warrior monk. He's a loner that reads books on war, and he thinks it's fun to kill people. But Trump's pretty confident that there's not going to be any more mistakes about toppling governments.
Good stuff.
David, this is La La Land, fantasy land. It's The Simpsons, which has become rules-based foreign policy.
And we will see, I suspect, the gradual erosion of the delight that greeted the election of Donald Trump. Delight that it wasn't Hillary Clinton who was completely controlled by Wall Street, and completely controlled by the military-industrial complex, and was angling to start a shooting war with Russia. And so we got someone who was going to shake things up a bit. We got a wild card. We got something that would get some form of change. And I think that's what the Americans actually voted for, was please change something. Let's have enough of this.
Yeah.
But we've got Mad Dog running the defense department, and we've got a Goldman Sachs executive running the Treasury Department. So it's not looking good, Brian.
That's absolutely true. I think, here we are on this slide. We can just bring in bottom right. We've got Steven Mnuchin, former Goldman Sachs partner. So, I mean, these are clearly the people that you need to be helping to put together a good US. The banks don't make any money out of wars, so that all fits, really, I think. Sorry, a little bit of sarcasm creeping in. Well, I'm suspicious, so I went looking for defence. I also went looking to see who was going to educate the forthcoming generations of American children. And here she is, the Education Secretary, top right, Betsy DeVos. She's labelled by the Telegraph as an entrepreneur and philanthropist. Always good words. So let's have a look at her. Here she is. This is her website featuring herself. I didn't have to go far into this to get an idea what this lady is about. Let's bring up some of the initial comments. She's a proven leader, an innovator, a disruptor. So here we've got classic language and an advocate in education, in business, in politics. Betsy has been a pioneer in fighting to remove barriers, to enact change, and to create environments where people have the opportunity to thrive. So this is a remarkable woman, unbelievably wealthy, very powerful. She's a leader. She believes in change. She believes in disrupting in order to get that change in, whether the public will want it enough. And you can see she's wearing the right clothes. This is Theresa May type uniform. So I'm conservative. I'm sort of trustworthy. Trust me with your children. Well, let's have a little look, see whether we should do that. So we'll bring in Trump. He's, of course, saying that your children are safe with me. And let's bring in Betsy. Well, she is actually a billionaire. We'll come on to that. And apart from all of her good work, she's working, with WinQuest Group, and that's investment and management firm. So let's bring in hubby. Here he is, Dick DeVos. He's an entrepreneur, businessman, and he just happened to be the chief executive officer of Amway, the pyramid selling company that, of course, wasn't pyramid selling. Well, it was, but it wasn't. But it made a huge amount of money out of operating a sort of pyramid selling. Mm. Well, who was his dad? Well, let's bring in Daddy. Richard DeVos. One's Dick, one's Richard. Richard DeVos, co-founder of Amway. And this is where the wealth comes from, a mere $5 billion. And I was interested to see this man is allegedly a Christian. I find that difficult to believe since he's sitting on $5 billion while people are starving. But apparently he's a Christian. And as I was recovering from the newfound knowledge over the state of education in America, I just happened to pick up that Betsy has a brother. And here he is. He just happens to be Eric Prince, the founder of the mercenary outfit Blackwater, now known as Academy. So it seems to me that American children are in a pretty safe pair of hands there, David. Or am I just too cynical?
No, I don't think you're too cynical. I don't think it's possible any longer to be too cynical. I think those days have gone. Blackwater. I wasn't seeing that one coming. That was a surprise. The language that's used talks about disruption and change. It doesn't give any indication of what these people actually believe in. It doesn't give any indication as to what you're getting. You're asked to sign up, like Obama, vote for change. It means different things to different people. It means nothing. But they all use the same language. So it's some form of club, but it doesn't reveal anything about what they think is right, what they think is wrong, what they want to achieve. And that means that there is no argument about what the objectives are, because the objectives are entirely hidden.
Indeed, and I'll just add to this, many years ago I was invited to go to an Amway conference in Plymouth, which I did out of idle curiosity. And amongst all of the razzmatazz, as people were given huge prizes because they'd built up more of the pyramid selling scam and were running teams of other pyramid sellers, I found that the hall, the conference hall, was full of the most unbelievably unpleasant atmosphere. There was something tangibly dark and I'll describe it as evil in that particular conference room. And when I came away, I thought, well, whatever is going on there, they may be making huge amounts of money for a very small number of people. But there was something about the whole culture that I found particularly disturbing. I've never forgotten it. So I was just fascinated to know that this culture is now going to help frame the minds of forthcoming generations of American children. I think they're at risk. A response, if you like, David, to that.
Well, I think that's an entirely correct analysis. The thing that totalitarian governments do is they always go for the children. We know that in Scotland. We've seen it time after time in history. And we need to be watching very carefully what's coming on and showing that there are other options and taking those other options.
Indeed. Well, I've had this slide on many times before, but let's bring it on. This was the year 2000, and it's Tony Blair, who, of course, has now been cleared of all wrongdoing. He's just an ordinary political party representative working in our best interest. But in 2000, he said that he had a vision of a new Britain. Central to this vision is the creation of a new class, a new elite placed in positions of authority who will propagate the new spirit of the age and spread the principles of the third way across Britain. And we've just been talking America. It's exactly the same system, America or Britain. We're now seeing these appointed people. We don't appoint them. They appoint themselves. But they're going to change everything about our society. And what you need to assist is some good fake news. So we better bring in The Guardian. And the state is an enabler of sexual violence. So what hope for the victims? Well, I saw the headline and I thought, is The Guardian going to be talking about children who are abused by members of the political elite or the establishment? Is The Guardian going to start to investigate what's really happening in the cover-up of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of child sexual victims? Are they going to be looking at where the 300 plus Syrian children disappeared to? No. What is The Guardian up to? It's making outrageous claims that one in four women will suffer from violence from men. One in four. And then it says, well, the whole problem is caused by the fact that women's organisations are losing funding. If you don't give the money to the charities, you're going to get more violence. And it's also compounded by changes to the welfare system and cuts to legal aid and more. So I'm happy to label that fake news. But of course, it seems that they'll do anything and everything to get men and women at each other's throats because this is a good way of breaking up the family.
Well, there's more of that coming. But before we get onto it, let's stick with the fake news and The Guardian, because they are absolutely apoplectic about this fake news and insidious trend that's fast becoming a global problem. And as you read down this, as you can see there, they've got, what, one, two, three, four, five, six or seven different journalists involved in this, because the article itself is describing the fake news, which is coming out of a whole bunch of different countries around the world. And The Guardian quite recently, well, in fact, in this article, they link to another article also in The Guardian, the peddlers of fake news are corroding democracy. I have to say that if they consider the likes of us to be peddlers of fake news, I am going to say that I'm quite happy to be corroding this particular insidious form of democracy. It's not democracy at all. We can think of, Dave and I were discussing the various words we could use to describe it before the programme. But, you know, I'm quite happy to corrode what they describe as democracy if this is what they're really pushing. But also linked to this whole fake news thing, you mentioned, Brian, the fact that they're trying to set men against women, but it's not just men against women, because, of course, part of the fake news story is the so-called alt-right. Well, the Washington Post here pushing the idea that the GOP is now pushing the alt-left, and the alt-left, of course, is the extreme end of the Democratic Party. And so we've now got the alt-right and the alt-left. But it's not just in the United States that we're dividing people, because this was a pretty incredible, also in The Guardian, a pretty incredible article from Michael Mansfield, QC. And he's saying why our 21st century democracy needs the spirit of 1647. Now, of course, 1647 was the height of the British Civil War, the English Civil War, which culminated in cutting the head off a monarch. Well, if that's what he's proposing, then maybe I could see that there's some people would have some sympathy with that under the circumstances. But nonetheless, he's saying that, I'll just read the first little bit. He says the imminent Article 50 hearings in the Supreme Court should herald a debate for more fundamental, far more fundamental than that concerning the way Brexit has triggered. Over the past 50 years, the UK has seen the growth of democratic deficit that has brought us to the brink of bankruptcy. Ironically, the sovereignty of the Westminster Parliament was the crux of the Leave argument against Europe. Yet the Brexiters are now railing against this argument upheld in the Court of Appeal that Parliament, not just the Prime Minister, must authorise the Article 50 mechanism for exit. And so he goes on and he describes how Parliament is sovereign and that we've got an uncodified constitution, we have an antiquated remnant of absolute monarchy, which is the royal prerogative that can be invoked where secondary legislation avoids proper scrutiny. And so he goes on. So he makes some reasonable points, but at the same time, he's not really coming from what might be a reasonable point of view. For example, he's calling for constitutional reform. He's calling for a national convention on the constitution. And of course, he's citing exactly the types of groups that we would not want to be involved in that constitutional convention. For example, COMPAS, Open Democracy, Unlocked Democracy, Assemblies for Democracy, the Green Party. And then he goes on to say that in 1688, a combination of parliamentarians and the Dutch monarchy overthrew James II to establish the supremacy of Parliament, especially in matters of taxation, appointments, royal succession, and the right to wage war. The 1689 Bill of Rights set the seal on these developments: free elections, freedom of speech in Parliament, regular parliaments, and the norm of governance by consent. Doesn't mention the right to bear arms in our own defence. And then he says, now is the time to reach back into history and stem the advance of the new elite. Nothing should be off the table. The monarchy, the House of Lords, the relationship between the constituent parts of the UK, our outdated voting system. Questions about all this have been floating around for a long time, but rarely has the need to address them been so urgent. We need to create a democracy fit for the 21st century in which the power of the people predominates over the people in power. So some good points, some not so good points, but overall, I thought it was pretty interesting that a senior QC in Britain, David, is invoking memories of the Civil War at a time like this.
Yes, and somewhat sinister as well. The Cromwell approach to civil liberties is not, I think, the model we want to be going with. It was centralizing, it was top down, it was oppressive. There's a pretty little loch not far from where I'm sitting that is only a body of water, because that's where Cromwell camped his army, and the local landowner was so affronted that Cromwell had put his army there that when the army left, he flooded the field and turned it into a lake, so he never had to look at it again. I think that sort of commitment to individualism is what we need, not more Cromwellian central control. I would also point out a couple of things that you said earlier on the fake news. Anyone who's interested in what is actually the situation with domestic violence should read Erin Prizzi. She's the person who founded the first women's shelter in London. She's suffered death threats and years of intimidation because she will not buckle to the approved line on this. and instead speaks the truth. And what she found was when there was violence in the home, about a quarter of the time the man was violent towards the woman, about a quarter of the time the woman was violent towards the man, and about half the time you had chaotic homes in which violence was mutual and frequent. And that was the reality that she was dealing with, not the liberal agenda that's been put forward. And the other thing, and just to finish off on fake news, I thought it reached the absolute pinnacle of fake news when the Washington Post reported Russian propaganda helped spread fake news during the election, experts say. That was the headline. A flood of fake news this election season got support from a sophisticated Russian propaganda campaign that created and spread misleading articles online with the goal of punishing Democrat Hillary Clinton and helping Donald Trump. So it's all the Russians.
Yes. Okay. Well, look, we're totally out of time, but let's just quickly end on this. I mean, it could be argued that the Foreign Office perhaps it should be looking outside the United Kingdom, and maybe this is understandable, but nonetheless, it is quite amusing that the Twitter team doesn't seem to recognise landmarks in their own country.
Yes, the Queensferry crossings, a bridge too far for the Foreign Office here. This was Design is Great, talking about the new Queensferry crossing and showing the original Forth Bridge, which was completed in 1890. So there we go. I suppose at least they got the right country. So for the Foreign Office, that might be viewed as a win.
Yes. Okay.
Well, that picture brings back lots of happy memories being based in Rosyth there, David. So thank you for that. I think I know those bridges, at least from the Seaward side, pretty well. There was a stunned silence.
It's a very nice part of the world. And I and actually it was the bridge you showed there, although it was the wrong bridge, that Forth Bridge, that was the moonshot of the 19th century. It was a new material. It was a bigger span. It was the greatest single engineering advance really ever in the history of structural engineering. So it's worth showing, but we should try and get it right, lads.
Yeah,
it's true. Okay, that brings us to the end of today's news. David, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to all our viewers and listeners. If you're not yet a subscriber of UK Column, please consider joining up to help us. We do need your support, and we need continuing financial support to enable us to do what we do. We would also like to expand the range of programs and documentaries that we're currently undertaking. We hope we'll have some news on that for the new year. But if you're not a supporter, please consider making a donation or taking out that subscription. We'll be back same time on Monday. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.